You ever wonder about the people in family photos or ever try to ask who these people really were? Every face is a narrow escape or a love story that almost didn't happen. Your family stories are hidden in plain view. You just haven't accessed it yet. There are versions of these rebels and dreamers before life told them who they needed to be. And I'm not talking about the shiny stories everyone knows. I'm talking about the soul-crushing experiences with heartbreaks and real loss. You gotta preserve these stories now. So contact thevietnamstorybank.com today. No polish, just raw, recorded, beautiful history that makes you sit up and hold your breath. We dig it all up, record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, unerased, untouchable, and unforgettable. Don't let silence have the last word. Go to vietnamstorybank.com today. Make sure your family's stories are recorded.
Welcome to the Vietnamese Podcast, everybody. I have Quentin Nguyen Duy here with me today. And I've been following you for a long time now. And thank you for coming on the podcast.
Oh my gosh. Thanks so much for having me, Kenneth. I've listened to this podcast since I started getting into the entertainment industry after college. And it's been so essential in me understanding, like, you know, the Vietnamese American film scene, actor scene. It's so awesome to finally be on it. Thank you for asking.
You. That's very flattering. I want to ask you, since, you know, a lot of us know you from your Instagram account. Mm-hmm. And, you have a lot of skits, a lot of funny stuff. But before we get to all of that work, how did you grow up? Where did you grow up? How are you related to the Vietnamese diaspora?
Sure, totally. Thanks for asking. Yeah, I grew up in a plethora of places. My mom and my dad met in New Mexico, and I was born in Oregon. I moved to France for my first year of life. Both my parents are artists. My dad is Pipo Nguyen. He's a photographer. My mom's a painter. And we moved around a lot. We went from France back to Oregon. I lived on a farm in Oregon for about a couple of years. And I went to Ohio. I lived in Oberlin, Ohio for a couple of years. We were in San Francisco, Headlands, for a little bit. I grew up primarily in a place called Ashland, Oregon, where there's a Shakespeare Festival. And then I moved to Ohio for a couple of years in high school, Oberlin, Ohio. And then I went to a boarding school called Interlochen Arts Academy for my final years of high school to study acting when I was like 16.
Wow. And where'd you get the acting bug?
I know, dude. There must have been someone down the lineage. I mean, both of my parents are visual artists. I was always a really shy kid, you know, so it was kind of a surprise when I got into acting, but it's been really my only focus since I was 16. I haven't done anything else, essentially.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's really the thing that you want to really pursue and carry on for the rest of your life.
Yeah, being in the entertainment industry. Now, you know, more so a holistic approach, like, you know, I'd be happy anywhere I land. But when I was 16, I did my first play and I never had any focus. You know, I was a skateboarder. I wasn't good enough to go pro, but I didn't really have any other hobbies. I was kind of just like ran with like a troublemaking crowd. I didn't have any hobbies. I didn't do well in school. And so when I did my first play, I got the lead role and I felt really good, and I just never considered another career path or another endeavor ever since. You know, there was
I love hearing that.
Anything else? Yeah. Super one track minded.
You know, and honestly, I think that's what it takes, right? It really just takes that single focus, because then it's like, you're not really working. Mm-hmm. It's not really painful, you know?
Yeah.
And if you have that inside voice that's telling you that this is it, eventually it becomes it.
Yeah. 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 I mean, there's always that thing in my head where I look back and I'm like, man, should I have been an accountant? That'd be kind of great right now, mm-hmm. You know? But it's like, if you just pursue something with confidence, eventually, like, you won't know any other routes, and you'll just have to assume whatever you picked was right, you know? Especially if you feel like that thing has a really strong purpose, all of the pain that you go through trying to achieve that thing will feel like it is leading to something. It won't feel like useless pain. You know, so it's kind of like that for me.
Yeah. And I think it all adds up too. The pain, quote unquote, really adds to the whatever you're doing, whether it's podcasting or acting, mm-hmm. it adds to the art, because that journey of how difficult this can be for mm-hmm. all of us, it adds up and it shows up in our art.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, like, you know, a lot of people listening to this podcast, you know, if you're Vietnamese American or Asian American or you're a minority, there's a ton of odds stacked against you in almost any industry in the U.S., right? And especially if you're in entertainment, there's such a lack of representation. So I think those obstacles can also fuel you to feel like, oh, no, the work I'm doing is actually more important than that other guy over there. Because it might be easy for them, but they're actually not trailblazing as much as I am by starting this podcast or trying to be a writer or trying to be an actor. So I find it, just like you're saying, it adds to it.
You know? But let me ask you though, I am curious about what you just said. Mm-hmm. Do you think really that there are blocks? I mean, I have an idea, but mm-hmm. I want to hear it from you. Do you really think that there are blocks and obstacles for people of color?
Yeah. I'm going to have my opinions about this. Yeah, totally. I think
can you talk about it?
Yeah, I can speak.
Are you comfortable talking about it?
Okay. Of course, my unique perspective of being primarily an actor for the past decade professionally. I think when I was especially younger, I experienced a ton of just a severe lack of representation, especially of Southeast Asian actors, Southeast Asian male actors. You can look at the sort of etymology of that lack of representation at things like Miss Saigon or plays that depict Southeast Asian men as, you know, background or extras, you know, like Apocalypse Now, anything in entertainment, right? You don't really have any leading Southeast Asian men. You have East Asian men leading. You have white men leading, but you don't have Southeast Asian men doing anything. So when I was a kid, especially going into college, I just didn't get any roles. Like all the plays that at my school were going to be plays that were about any other person's experience except for mine. And then when I got out into the real world auditioning, there's way less roles. It can play to an advantage because I can fill that niche, but at the same time, it's just way harder odds. You're not going to be sent as many jobs.
But wait a minute. Let me just be frank. And for all the people who are listening to this in an audio podcast, Quentin is white passing, mm-hmm. right? Let's just call it what it is. You're white passing.
Yeah.
But I know it is probably hard for Asian men, right? Yeah. But I've always wondered, like, for Asian men not having, let's just say you're, all right.
Yeah.
They look at you and they're like, okay, you're Asian. But do you think that it's a lack of roles, or do you think it's like we're not acting well enough?
Mm.
Well, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, okay? So please don't crucify me, people out there. I'm not saying Asian men can't act. I'm just saying, I'm just posing a question.
Well,
is it a question?
It's a valid point. I mean, if you think about it, like, say if you're, you know, for say white, you've been in the States for a very long time and you've prospered economically. So you're going to be given opportunities to do things like the arts that don't necessarily make money, right? So you'll have a father who is an actor, you'll have a grandfather who is an actor, and those things will be encouraged for you to do, right? And so I think that you just have a larger pool of artists who are Caucasian or any other race other than, you know, Southeast Asian. If you come to the States as a refugee in 1975, you're not going to have your parents put you into arts programs. Now we're getting an influx of actors because we've prospered a little bit, but there's a so much smaller pool of talent. So what you say by like, oh, maybe we're not acting well enough. It's like, well, yeah, that's probably it, because statistically we don't have as many people to create like outliers of talent. I'm massively privileged by being white passing and having that, but still having my last name be what it is. And also, you know, I do have, you know, Asian lineage, especially growing up when I kind of looked a little bit more Asian. This is kind of a weird thing that happens with Asians, is sometimes we look Asian growing up and we look a little whiter as we get older. I really don't know what it is. Probably the additive of facial hair. It still factors a little bit into that, you know, but I think, yeah, I think that's a massive barrier, is just not having that sort of like push into the arts as we're kids, you know.
And then when you are starting out so young, you said 16, mm-hmm. how do you know if you're good?
I can actually
answer how do you know, because I've asked this question so many times, but I want to hear it from you, right?
Okay.
But there is a kind of way that you know you're good.
Great.
But now, I want to hear like what
I will tell you my answer only on the condition that you tell me your answer after, because I would love to know this.
Okay. Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah, of course.
I think I knew I was good because it was the only thing I was ever good at. I mean, I was moved schools 4 times in high school, and it was my second school I moved to. I like just did not know a single person. And someone handed me like a little monologue. It's like a little page of text. And he was like, you should audition for drama club. It's like a theater thing. You basically join a group. And I was like, yeah, sure. So I spent all day with this monologue running it in my head. I had a lot of fun doing it. I practiced it in front of my dad. My dad was like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm auditioning for drama club. And then I remember like a week later seeing the cast list, and I was the lead of the school play. And it was like a brand new school. I didn't know a single person. I haven't even introduced myself to someone yet. And I mean, it doesn't seem like that cool of a thing now, you know, because like now, you know, I'm trying to book the leads of movies in Hollywood. So a school play in Ohio isn't that cool. But as like a 16-year-old that had failed everything in life, like I had really flunked out of freshman year. I was sent away after my freshman year to like, you know, to live somewhere else. And I sucked at skateboarding. I wasn't good enough to even get sponsored. And I was essentially headed to nowhere. And so like to get such a massive rush of validation, even though it's a very trivial thing in retrospect, was it just always cemented itself as like, oh, this is something you should lean into. So I'd hate to say to know that you're good, you need that external validation and to be picked. But I think as you grow up, you get hints of like what you're not going to achieve greatness at and what you can potentially be pretty good at through events like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately, defining good does require comparing ourselves to whatever that standard is out there. And here's what I mean by that. Like if you go for auditions and you keep not getting them, you're tripping over lines.
Yeah.
You don't remember your shit. That's when you know you're not good. And when you know you're good is when you are learning these things and it seeps in and it just stays with you. And you keep getting called back over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And you just start to look out at the landscape and you're like, wait, so I'm getting picked 80% of the times over like my peers. That's when you know you're good. And it takes years to kind of validate that, right? Yeah. But it does require a little bit of comparison. Mm-hmm. And they say comparison can be the thief of joy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it could also be the validator that you are moving in the right direction.
Definitely. Is that your... Okay. Oh, really? Okay.
Well, I went through it. I wanted to be a singer. And I went through that path for 6 years and I couldn't remember melody. I couldn't remember rhythm and lyrics the way my classmates in school. And I was a little older at the time. I went back to school for music, I think I was 25. I'd been singing since I was 18.
Sure.
You know, vocal classes over and over again through undergrad. But to do it professionally, I was in school with like 30 other vocalists and I was just watching maybe 5 of them pick up a sheet. They look it. They sung it 3 times, locked it in, and then they got on stage and they nailed it with the band.
Yeah, yeah.
Took me 1,000 times to do that one thing. Mm. And I'm like, there's no way. There's no way you can do that.
Well, the self-awareness is key. And you would school me at karaoke, I can guarantee you. Yeah. You still absolutely obliterate me at karaoke. So that's something.
that's hilarious. But that is, I think, the journey of like, trying all these different things in life. Like my daughter, she can just pick up a song and, you know, I can just see it. It's like, but her mother is a good singer, you know, and her mother can remember lyrics, melody, and rhythm really quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, at she's like 8 years old. And I'm like, there's a way to do this. Cause if you have the talent, then you just got to work really hard to be not just good, but you got to like work at being great. And I think that's,
it's how fast you can respond to training, right? So like I trained as an actor at 16, right? And I wouldn't say when I entered the training program, I was better than any other kids. I was starting significantly behind because 16 might sound like young to be an actor, but a lot of my peers when I went to prep school were
8.
And their their mothers and fathers were failed actors. He wanted them to audition since they were like two. And so like for me, I was like 16 years behind all these other kids. So I lacked a lot of technical skill in just everything really until I was like 22 or 23 and I had trained for, you know, like 4 or 5 years. I think it's how it's also a matter of if you can be good at it, do you sustain enough curiosity to pursue that thing? Is it fun enough and meaningful enough for you to keep going with it? I know a ton of kids who were like fantastic at acting, but didn't have the tenacity to keep learning and didn't have like the humility to also be taught and couldn't handle rejection. So they just fizzled out by the time they graduated college, you know? So I think that's also a factor when you're thinking about like success is like, you know, can you pick it up quick? Are you naturally good at it? And do you have the passion and the drive to sustain through the hard times, you know, with whatever you pick?
I was listening to an interview on a podcast the other day with an agent, and I can't remember who it was, but the agent was like quoting a producer, a music producer, and he was saying, the real challenge that we as producers are looking for is not the talent, because, you know, you can work all that in the recording studio, not the looks, you know, all of those things. There's a range, there's a gamut of all of that range of looks and talent. If you study the history of musicians and singers, but what we're looking for really is the ones that are immune to getting beat down. Because that ultimately, when a producer with money invests in you as an artist, they want to keep placing the bet on that horse. The whole industry, like if you're an actor, right? We want to make sure that this guy will never get his ass whooped and that we're putting down a $5 million bet on his salary. Mm-hmm. He better like show up and not be afraid to get hurt or to get, you know, and I mean hurt as an ego and all of that. Oh, like totally. This guy is undamageable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what that producer was meaning, is that this is a game of attrition. It's a war of attrition when it comes to artistry.
Yeah. No, 100%. I mean, I think that's something that's touched on too. I want to touch on too with the greatest thing is also like when you get into the real world, you face knowing you're good as an actor is actually really hard because the baseline, the norm is rejection, right? Like even if you go up, I mean, I will say my statistics off the top of my head are probably on average about 190 auditions a year, which I book one or two jobs, right? And that's actually without any sort of there. I can go on an Excel spreadsheet and I can compile the data. That's actually without any exaggeration. And that's maybe not counting a couple short films from some students. I'm not going to count those. Those are like the jobs that actually pay for my year. So it's like crazy because, right, your agents are sending you things and you feel like your back's against the wall and you are getting rejection after rejection after rejection. You also have to hold a little bit of inner like validation when the world's not giving you any sort of like, hey, you're really good at this, we think you should keep going. You have to really hold a lot of belief in yourself and know the line between being completely delusional and unself-aware and also like being just tenacious enough to keep going in this industry. So it's actually a very hard thing, you know? I think that knowing you're great also has to be something that you hold internally as well as hopefully you're getting feedback from the outside world. But there's years where, and we can get into that later with the career stuff, but there are years where you will not hear a single person clap except for yourself, you know?
Man, that is intense.
Intense. And I think a lot of people know being an actor is hard, but they don't understand that the rejection to acceptance rate is actually like 98% rejection.
Sounds like more. For 190 more. And it's 190 and you're only booking once or twice a year.
Yes. You know, and that's why you can see I'm so bad at math that this is the career path I had to choose. I can't even go into accounting if I fail at this.
You inspire me, you know, when I think about your journey, this is why I do what I do, because I get to listen to this inspiring journey. You've been at it for 10 years. I've only been at it for 6 years. And for me, I just knew because it was just so easy to talk to people and I didn't really care about the money.
Yeah.
And that's when I knew I'm built for this and it's going to be impossible for anybody to kind of like compete with me because this is what I love doing.
Yeah.
I love sitting here and I love talking and asking questions about the guests. And I think that that's when you know, I think, you know, because I've been through a few art, you know, I write, I sing. Just going through these processes makes you realize, like, you got it there, but you don't have it here. Or you have it here, but, you know, and that longevity and that kind of like the mileage, I could see way out into the tundra, you know, like I'll survive any cold frostbite. I'll make it to the other side of the tundra where there's like green grass growing with the forest. I'm going to make it.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of like what I'm hearing from you. You know, it's
no, totally. And you know, like there's no, you know, being an artist, such a multifactorial pursuit, you know, I'm sure that all of the things, the artistic endeavors that you really try to pursue before podcasting and elevating other artists has factored massively into your practice now, you know, and developing your self-awareness of what you're good at and what you need work on and sort of working that muscle of perseverance, you know. I think like everyone in the arts, is such a weird thing. It's like you kind of know your destination, like it's like somewhere over the mountain, but you don't know what road you're going to take. You know, it's like you're like, I kind of want to be in Hollywood, but like, does that mean I'm a producer? Does that mean I'm a writer? Does it mean I'm an agent? Does it mean I'm an actor? And I don't think any road is, I think people find success in any road, you know? So when I look at, you know, a career over the long run, you know, I think that people just inhabit multiple roles, you know, and each one builds some sort of like talent in the opposing road, you know.
And I think you just don't know which road, because out of 100 roads, one road will bring an accidental benefit meeting that changes the trajectory of your life.
Yeah.
And another might bring it, instead of the first one doing it in 2 years, the other one might do it in 6 years. You just have to like, you really just have to take all the opportunity you can get.
Yeah, it's a complicated thing, but the thing is, as long as you have that inner drive and that passion, that optimism to go towards what you want, you'll find a way to get there, and you'll never know which way you'll take. It'll probably differ massively from what you initially expected, but you know, I think that's so important. The arts, as tangential as that is.
Yeah. Before we go into like what you're currently up to, I'd love to hear, in the last 10 years, if you almost ever dropped out.
Oh my God, dude. That's such a great question. I gotta start asking people that when I'm at dinner parties. Because it's just going to bear so many fruitful answers. If you ask artists like, hey, did you ever quit? Do you think this is a bad idea? Yeah, it's like after 196 rejections, were you ever like, maybe this is just not economically feasible? Now, I think,
10,900, if we're going to add it up times 10, it's like almost 11,000 no's.
That's fantastic. I don't even can have that mathematical capability. I think, which is probably why I'm still doing it. What did I ever quit? Yeah, I did. I had actually very early on. When I was about, let's see, there's two times, if I'm going to be super honest. When I went to prep school, I went from a public school to a boarding school, and everyone was so ahead of me. And I had this passion, I had this love for this thing when I was around 16. And I just like realized I just sucked, you know, like I was the top of the top in my public school. But then when I went to boarding school, I was just, it was such a cutthroat environment going from public school to private school. It was such a elitist environment. I was kind of the poorest kid there in like my dorm like house. And I was also the only Asian actor in my cohort, Asian American male actor. And I was the least skilled, like just like objectively talking about it. I had found it the year before. Everyone there had been there for at least 4 years and had done it since childhood. And I didn't book a single speaking role that year. And it was really hard because I had to convince my dad like to let me go. And I had to spend the whole summer like selling trinkets on the street. My dad made these like little little phone speakers that people put their phone in and played. So I sold enough funds. I made like a lot of money to get myself there and got a scholarship, and he paid the rest of the tuition, you know, on the basis that I would go and I would flourish. But I just really failed, like flat out. I didn't get a single speaking role. I got into a lot of trouble. I got suspended for a month. And I think I like spent that month of suspension back in my room in Ohio. And I was just like, yeah, that's, I'm not made for it. So after that year, because I was suspended for the month that college applications were due, I didn't apply to anywhere for college. And I ended up going to Oberlin College because my dad works for Oberlin. So I had like submitted a Common App thing and I went undeclared and I studied journalism. But during that year, I was just so obsessed with theater. Like I would go, I was that weird kid. I would go to the plays that they put on to teach people like sex ed. I would like go to the plays where it's like about like demonstrating like rules on campus, and I would watch the performances and be like, oh, what worked in this play about like rules on campus? What worked here? And I directed a play. I directed This Is Our Youth. I was the first freshman in a lot of years to actually have a full length play produced that I directed. I was in plays. I was auditioning. I was writing plays, getting my like professors to kind of oversee playwriting projects. And at one point, like I was just like, you know, I'm just at a school doing theater that's not a theater school. I should just go back if this is what I really want to do, despite how painful it was to fail my first time. So I auditioned for Boston University. I got a full scholarship and I went there for 3 years. And wow,
that's a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. That was really, it was Boston University, a fantastic, fantastic program. But that was like my year of just, I really threw in the towel after I tried. Just because I think I wasn't used to rejection. I wasn't used to competing at a high level. I was such a slacker for my adolescence, you know? So when I tried to do it, it was just a shock to the system, you know?
So you got to see, before you quit, you got to see like people performing at the highest levels, like these kids.
Those kids were really talented. And, you know, some of them are very successful there, but the bulk of them actually didn't continue in the arts, you know? And I think some of that early, like, yeah, child actor stuff is actually like, I mean, it's a cliche for a reason. Like, you know, I remember looking at these kids and being like, oh my God, you know, I can't even compete in the same level of them ever. And now they're not even acting, you know, there's a few of them from my classmates who are just brilliant, who are still doing this for a living. But, you know, I think I just made a judgment when I met them and I was like, oh, like they are more worthy of this path than I am. And I should just stay back and be a skateboarder or do something outside the arts, you know?
Do you still feel that way every now and then?
I mean, every actor has like a very deeply seated kind of feeling of insecurity. I think it's what drives us to keep trying to get external validation. But I don't entertain that thought anymore. Like, you know, I'm as worthy as anyone to be here, you know? That's what they want you to think, man. Especially, you know, I'm definitely white passing, but especially if you're a minority, that people just want you to think like, I'm not as worthy as the rest of these people here. Like, you know, it's just not, I try to fruit ninja that thought out of my head if it ever comes up, you know.
A fruit ninja that thought?
Okay, so a co-star of mine on this show called Hunting Party, her name is Sarah Garcia. She plays Jennifer Morales on the show. She says that every time she has a bad actor thought, like an insecurity, she fruit ninjas it. And I just think it's a fantastic CBT term. It's great. It's great.
I'm going to start using that with my kids. You all get it. You know, once you say that, it's like, and it just disappears.
Exactly. It's like, oh, I shouldn't audition for this. I'm not right for it. It's a like, fruit ninja that thought. Or, oh, that rejection means I'm not talented. It's like fruit ninja that thought, you know. The second time I ever quit, and I'll TLDR this, but the second time I ever quit was at a horrible time when I was 25. It just like my whole world went to, I mean, we had the SAG strike and then we had COVID and all this stuff. But I did the Asian Baby Girl pilot. We could talk about that later. And it was a massive high. I was a series regular, one of the leads on that show with a brilliant director, Den Tai, and my friend Lin Kim Do and Kathy Bui and Giselle. But it didn't get picked up, sadly, by the network. And I just, that kind of like rejection, it felt like at that kind of age of 24 hit really hard. And then that same week that I got the news, the pilot was redlit. My agency, which is A3, imploded and it just burst. And so I got those two pieces of news when I was like 25. And I really didn't know what to do at the time. I was kind of the lowest of the low. I hadn't booked in like 1 year. I didn't have an agent. The thing that I thought was going to work out didn't work out. I've been auditioning like crazy. I was a personal trainer full time at that point too. And I was very, very depressed that week. I auditioned for a play, and the play I auditioned for, the casting director introduced me to my agent now. And then that was sort of like felt like a very kismet moment. But I did think for a moment there, like, oh man, like, is all this hardship really, the emotional roller coaster of this really sustainable, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Really cool story.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
And when did you start getting on the Instagram sort of work? Because, you know, I think sometimes now producers will look, you know, to see if an actor has a following or, you know, and, you know, how did this all come about?
Sure. Great question. I mean, Instagram for me was such a random additive to my life. I was always that guy with an Instagram with like 2,000 followers and like one selfie of me a year.
Yeah.
No, I never cared about it because I came from the theater, and theater actors from New York, I think we always just kind of like scoffed at social media. But I met a guy named Sam Lee. He's one of the actors on The Brother's Son. He's also a creator. When I was shooting the Asian Baby Girl pilot, we all went out to dim sum, and I met him, and he was shooting Brother's Son at the time. And we just hit it off, and we started hanging out, and I would help him film some reels. And I thought it was so fun. I was also a playwright in college. I would write plays, and that was like a really big thing that I was passionate about. And so to me, it felt like writing plays. And after a while, he was like, you know, why don't you do your own thing? Why don't you try to do your own content? And I was like, dude, what the heck would I make content about? Like, I don't want to make... I just was like, what am I going to do? And then I met a buddy named Ray Cam, Daddy Dumpling, on Instagram. And we would all hang out. And Ray Cam does a lot of content about learning Cantonese. And at the time, I had been learning Vietnamese for about 3 years. So he was like, do content about learning Vietnamese. And so for me, I was like, okay, you know, I can practice my Vietnamese on a weekly basis. And I can also see what it's like to use Instagram. So I started using Instagram to connect with the language. And that was my only... Wow. That was my only goal. And now it's expanded towards more things. Yeah.
And do you find that now that you have, you know, this, the chops to kind of make these, does it add to your real life acting experience?
Yeah, I think a lot. I mean, you know, we live in a day and age where like media, the blurred line between vertical and horizontal entertainment is kind of blurring. And you see social media stars getting Amazon show deals. Yeah. You know, you see like people like Jerusky are now like hybrid celebrities that are
crazy.
More famous than Brad Pitt to Gen Alpha or something, you know?
Yeah, it's crazy to witness.
It's crazy. It's insane. You see like the even the showrunner of Unorthodox not overcompensating as a TikTok star. So I think since doing this, I've found a little more traction. But I think it's also really important for actors to create and on social media, because we just do so much work that's unseen. Like we do so many auditions that are so great and they're so funny, and we just think they're bad because they never get a response. Right. But like, I think it was a necessary survival thing for me, because I would put my stuff out into the ether and people would like it and share it and respond to it. And to create on a daily basis was really essential for my literal survival. I think that the exposure I've gotten, the following I've gotten, has helped, especially actually in the Vietnamese American kind of filmmaking context. World. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But mostly it's helped me because it's helped me just like feel validated in my art.
Wow. Know?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Have you been to Vietnam?
Yeah, I went recently. I've been 6 times now to Saigon.
Since when? Since what year?
I was 9 when I first went, and then a couple other times with my dad. But I think probably my most impactful times were like I visited from, I was off 2 episodes of Hunting Party, which is the show I just shot. I was there from December to early January, and it was just really impactful because I went there to film content in Saigon. My dad lives in D7. And I felt like I just really connected with people there. And I felt like there's a lot of creative energy and there's so many people doing awesome things over there. And it felt like a kind of a real homecoming and like it was just a really awesome time, you know?
When did your dad move there?
Well, he's there kind of like 6 months out of the year, but he has an apartment he's had since 2020.
Got it.
Yeah. But he's retiring this year. So I think he's probably going to spend more time there.
If I didn't have kids, I'd probably live in Vietnam.
I know, right? Quality of life, dude. It's just so good. I ride my scooter around. I like stop for noodles at every corner.
No question about it. No question.
I know.
I've gotten crucified for saying that online on other people's podcasts, other conservative. Oh, really? Yeah. They're like, then go back and live there. Why are you living here?
Got kids, man.
Kids. I don't want to pull my kids out of, you know, and the United States is a great place. Let's not get that wrong. You know, it's a great place. We have a lot of issues, but who doesn't have issues, you know?
Everyone has issues.
Yeah, we all have issues.
Yeah.
But when you think about the landscape of Vietnam and living in Vietnam and visiting Vietnam, do you ever think that you could live there and become a fixture there and, you know, blend in with the language and and integrate?
No, that's a great question. I don't think if I lived in Vietnam, I would never be Vietnamese. I mean, I'm not Vietnamese. I'm Vietnamese American, you know, and I'm very hyper aware of that when I'm there. I am a visitor, right? And so I can do it. I can do it respectfully and I can do it in a way that I think adds value to the community, but I will never be part of Vietnam in the way that someone who's born there is. And I can speak, you know, I can learn how to speak and all that, but I don't know if I'd be able to sustain a life there just by basis of that, you know. I'd always be at least Viet Kieu, you know, and people are very welcoming, right? It's the most welcoming country in the world. Everyone was to me. No one ever brought up my outsider status. No one ever made me feel inadequate for not being able to speak that well.
Nobody ever called you white passing.
No, plenty of people called me white passing. Are you kidding? To them, I'm just like a tall, like a Dutch man speaking Vietnamese, but not in any way that ever felt demeaning or hostile, you know?
So what's next? What's on the table for you these days? You know, what are you, you know, trying to push and work on?
Yeah. Super good question. Right now, I just finished 13 episodes of Hunting Party for the season 2. And that's a show on NBC, Peacock, and Netflix. And that was just a wonderful, awesome, wild ride. I play a character called Ben Jones. And I'm going into filming a new short film by director Josh Campbell called Mishi this weekend, actually. So I'm prepping for my role where I play like a chronically addicted gambler. And so there's some twists and turns in that role that I'm really excited for. And really, at the moment, I'm trying to double down with social media and just make quality content and really see where that train takes me this year. I started a joint kind of Instagram account with my friend Sam Lee called Performing Males on Instagram. So we're trying to ideate and populate that page with like a couple of skits, kind of like an Asian American Key and Peele type thing.
I love that.
I always try to package it as that because I love that group.
Key and Peele.
Legends.
Key and Peele, like legends. Legends. They are so brilliant with the work they do. And then you see, you know, Jordan Peele and the directing that he's done since he's left that Key and Peele. And it's just like amazing, just the work that they do.
He's incredible. I mean, you talk about hybrid artists. Jordan Peele is the OG social media to like actual legit Hollywood kind of like artists, you know. They're fantastic. I was watching one of their skits literally earlier today. I still watch their skits like religiously. They just made such an outstanding body of content, that group. So funny.
They did.
Yeah.
They did. And then you realize like before them, there were other teams of people doing it, but they didn't do it like that. Whatever their special sauce was, they didn't do it like that. And then when I think about Vietnam, well, go ahead. You were going to say something?
No, well, I think, you know, I want to hear your thought after that, but I think the special sauces, a lot of their skits are actually really socially conscious. They actually have a lot of critical thought behind them. Like, so much of them contain, like, actually really complex, kind of like race theory. If you look at a lot of their things and like having to do with being mixed African American, like some of them are just pointless and funny, but a lot of them are actually like way deeper than people give them credit
for. I would actually fight back with you about pointless and fun. I would fight back and say every one of them that you watch has social commentary.
Yes.
And I say that because it's always about something that's raw and wrong.
Yeah.
It's always... Right. And then they're straddling that boundary of like raw and wrong. And then you're like, then you watch like Get Out and you watch the movies that Jordan Peele makes, the horror films. And then there's all this social commentary.
Yeah.
You realize it's like, oh shit, this guy's like not just an entertainment filmmaker, but he's like making commentary on the United States that we live in.
And
go ahead.
No, I just think that you can tell that there's so much depth with the comedy trope. I think that's why it lives so long. You know, like he really lets loose in his long form stuff, but you can tell under the surface of like, you know, there is obviously the Black Ice skit is something that's actually like you can trail down like the stuff they're joking about and see a lot of complex theory on it. And there's even stuff that's like less kind of deep, like just the like fragile masculinity stuff, like. About, you know, just like how I was watching the like one where the guy's like, man, I'm a grown ass man. I don't want to have that. And he starts crying at the table. He's like, I'm a grown ass man. And you're like, oh, he's talking about how fragile
men's egos are.
Yeah. And so like, it's like really funny, but it's because I think they're so evergreen. They keep being repeated because they have so much, you know, actual depth behind them. You know?
So let me ask you, when you write, and you put together this stuff with Sam Lee, you said?
Yeah.
So when you put together your Key and Peele stuff, right? Uh-huh. Do you think about the quality level, the bar that you're trying to like, okay. Oh, and how do you know if you're like coming close to the target of what they've done?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, you think Key and Peele is such a funny, actually a really apt comparison because that's who I can't even be audacious enough to say I aspire to be like them because they're such greats, but I aspire to... you know, be a fraction of how great they were. I mean, I think for me, it's like I come from the playwriting world and I have so much experience in long form entertainment, like creating 120 page plays that are socially conscious, that are funny, that have been rehearsed for months before they go up. So when I entered the social media world, I have an equal amount of passion for just like dumb videos of like AI dogs, like fucking doing the nene or something, you know, like I think that like things are still funny that are like 30 seconds, but I always try to think like if I had a rubric, and I use this with Sam Lee, but I use it by myself too. It's like, does this thing have a message? Does it give something into the cultural like ethos that doesn't belong there previously? So like, for instance, me and Sam Lee just did a video called Asian Americans Returning Home to Their Motherland for the New Year or something. And we did the thing where we wore the Adidas viral jackets and we're like, we're being like, wow, like, you know, you can actually say shit, and everyone will think you're a native. And so, like, it was because we were there, and we were like, man, it's just so great to be, like, Asian where there's Asians. And we were looking around, there's, like, no Asians. And I was like, wow, we're, like, the most – we are so clipped. And CNN Style just did an article where they featured an interview from me and Sam because they were talking about the viral Adidas Chinese jacket and why it was a trend and how that video kind of exemplified that trend. And that kind of came about because when we're thinking of what videos to make and what videos to not make, we usually go with the ones that just have a little bit more of like, is this commenting on something that people are relating to? Is this like capturing a moment in time that should be studied from a sociological perspective? Like we had a bunch of videos about Hinge too, like about like unoriginal guys on Hinge and unoriginal girls on Hinge. And I think a lot of it was just like trying to find a moment in time for me. Even with my Asian stuff where it's like, we should talk about this. We should talk about something that's not talked about, you know? And if it doesn't fulfill that requirement for me, I don't want to pollute the world with more content in this oversaturated internet age than that already exists, you know?
There's an elephant in the room.
Yeah.
You know, the film industry is in peril.
Yeah.
It's in a lot of hot water. There's a lot of content on YouTube. There's a lot of content on Instagram. There's verticals now with other AKA micro dramas that are really replacing the position of film. Little long form feature films are being kind of like dwindling the roles. I mean, are you feeling that? Are you preparing for that journey ahead? Or are you just booking enough TV and film stuff that you don't really care?
There's a sort of competition between vertical dramas and TV. Is that what you're saying?
Feature film. Yeah. I think feature film, TV, not so much, but feature films are like kind of drying up.
Sure.
And then there's a lot of micro dramas that are, you know, doesn't have good actors. And
yeah. Well, for me, it's like, I think that like essentially my view is that things always remain the same. They just take different shapes. Like, for instance, there's always going to be a demand for long form, really good cinematic content that gives you something to think about and non long after you watched it. There's always going to be a huge market for just trash, right? Mm-hmm. And what soap operas were and what, you know, Viet dramas kind of are and like, you know, all the like kind of things are going to be now verticals. They're probably not going to air on TV, but I don't think it diminishes the market for actually, if you look at the Emmys this year, the TV shows are outstanding quality. Like, yeah. I think that a lot of movies have shifted to just being incredible limited series. The Pitt was just one of those medical dramas where I was like, this is just a trailblazing work of art in TV. Adolescence is something that Adolescence is mind blowing. And that's
crazy.
Like, insane. And it's like a play, right? It demonstrates so much technical skill from everyone involved. No VFX, no bad
one shot.
One shot, right? And same with the Pitt, shot in real time. That takes, as a writer, that takes so much skill. And I think I've seen unprecedented skill on TV. I think I've seen a little bit of the movie industry be diminished, but I do think that if you also look at, you know, the Oscars, like those things will always bring in a lot of audience. I do think there's going to be a rise in vertical like dramas and like micro dramas, but I don't think it's going to replace quality work. I think it's going to replace like what soap operas were, you know?
Yeah. I think I have to agree with this.
Yes.
You know, that assessment is probably right on the mark.
I mean, I hope, and right?
Yeah.
But yeah. What are you going to say?
No. I think so. But, you know, there's probably a lot of room left in Vietnam too for this, you know, growth. You know, like I think 80% of micro dramas, the vertical dramas on your phone, the market's in China. It's 80% China. And the rest of the world hasn't even caught up yet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
mind-blowing to think about.
It's mind-blowing. I mean, there is a market. I mean, I won't deny that. But I think a lot of people wonder if like vertical micro dramas are going to replace real TV. And to me, I just don't, I can't imagine a world where people are like, no, people aren't going to go to like vertical movie theaters. It's like, you're never going to like want to, it's just something I think that's like just a passive form of entertainment. I don't think it will replace any part of the industry.
I hope you're right. I hope it's like, you know, you can't always eat fast food. You only eat fast food maybe once a month, once a week. I mean, there's a lot of people eating it every day, but I mean, for the most part, as a healthy person, you don't want to eat it more than once a month.
Yeah.
But you know, at what level the high end market of making food is actually going away, it's diminishing. You know, these restaurants don't make money. So it's just the same thing with every industry that we're looking at these days. You know, it's like, the shifts are happening, but that's why I said, you know, in the beginning with you, you're in a very good place in this industry. You're not too late, not too early. The pocket of change is happening now, and you can get on quick enough and transform quick enough.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the artists who survive longest in this world are the ones who adapt, you know, and who can move freely. Like you have a podcast. You're just talking to me about how you wanted to write books about people in the film industry. And you listened to like a couple episodes of a podcast you really liked and then decided to make your own platform. Yeah. And for me, that's embracing something as opposed to shying away from it and demonizing it because it feels like it's foreign, you know? And hopefully we can continue to distribute like good quality content no matter what the platform is. I don't think I'll ever act in a vertical drama, but if I ever make like an internet series, you know, I'll try to make it as quality as possible and I'll also chop it up to vertical. But hopefully that vertical TV series has good writing in it and has good acting in it. It is only a fraction of my practice, you know?
I would be careful with saying never because, and here's why, what I think. I think right now it's all crap. Everything that's coming out in these verticals are just horrible.
Yeah.
But just like the iterative process of cooking or making art, I think things will get better, right?
Yeah. You're
going to get really good. And because if you think about it, it's just an evolution of an art form.
Mm-hmm.
And as they're getting better, instead of punching in close to make things cheaper, they're going to come out a little bit wider. And then at some point, they're going to max out on how far back they can, because, you know, then the details you can't see through your phone, whatever that is. But then the storylines are going to get so good because the competition is going to be fierce. And then they're going to be like, right now you have like actors that are not great in it, but then all of a sudden you have like the really good actors being, you know, so instead of putting down 300 grand to make a vertical and then making a million in sales off of it, you could probably put $1 million in a vertical and hope to get a runaway hit, like a $200 million vertical. You know, like, everybody's like, oh my God.
Mind blowing to think about.
Right?
But I don't, I mean, you're right. You're right. I don't disagree. That's just the natural progression of everything.
Totally. You know? And that's why I'm saying, maybe you shouldn't say never. Just said,
maybe it could happen. Yeah. If there's any vertical directors out there that think about their $1 million project, I might take you up on it.
Because what if they're like, you know, I'm like, I call my friends, like 20 of my friends, dude, did you just see the one that Quentin just did?
Yeah.
That shit is amazing. And then those 20, they're 50, 70 friends that they, and it just like exponentially multiplies. And so the ceiling is not, and I'm sure this is happening in China. It's no longer like you put, some people put 70 grand down to make a vertical. Some companies put up to 300 grand.
Yeah.
But they make, you know, 5 million, 10 million back. And you do that like 20 times a year. You're making a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
Dude. What if?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. What if? Insane. Yeah, go ahead.
But no, I would be crazy if there was such a thing as blockbuster verticals where, you know, I'm actually, it's funny I say that because I actually am, I'm participating in this thing called Short Form, which is like it's basically a platform that is for like very good quality vertical skit series. So like the series that I'm pitching for them, I can't talk about it too much now because it's kind of in development, but is like half drama, half comedy. I wanted to make something that had a little bit of meaning, but also was mostly funny, a 8-part series, 1 minute each. And so those will be in the efforts of elevating the sort of like content creator medium, which is like verticals, you know. And I think like, yeah, as it iterates throughout the ages, you'll probably get some really awesome stuff in the next few years, you know. It's mind-blowing to think about, you know. Next thing you'll know, I'll be on a vertical directed by Din Tai, you know. I'm gonna be like, oh my gosh,
shout out to our boy Din,
won an Emmy. Yeah.
That'd be funny. You coming out to LA anytime soon?
No plans yet, you know, but depends what happens with work, you know. Love LA. You're coming to New York soon?
I'm coming to New York next week.
How beautiful.
And you know, we'll meet up and hopefully you get to come to the panel that I put together at Columbia University with Tony Bowie.
Yeah.
And Sit Real Citrus with Brittany Tran over there, and we have Hien on the panels. We have Kevin Nguyen and we have Dustin Nguyen. We have three.
That's so exciting. You have like all the heavy hitters. I'm so excited.
Heavy hitters. Yeah. 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 Heavy hitters.
Yeah.
You know, I want to end with this question. What do you think the evolution of the Vietnamese culture for you specifically will be?
For evolution of Vietnamese culture in my life or evolution of Vietnamese culture at large?
I want to hear both.
Okay. That's an awesome.
You brought up two. I mean, I leave it open-ended, but you specified two. So let's answer with both of them.
Okay, sure. Totally. I could say, I could look at it in my life. I mean, I was raised, you know, by my mom, who's white. And I was raised, you know, apart from my Vietnamese American family for my formative years. So I had almost no connection except for kind of hearsay, you know, and my last name. I always felt a little bit like I would taste Vietnamese food and I would just crave it. And I would see, you know, like I would just gravitated towards like Vietnamese stuff a lot as a kid. And I always felt a little othered because it wasn't cool. It was still kind of looked down upon. I grew up in a lot of predominantly white places. And then in college, I think I met other Asian Americans and some Vietnamese, and I started stepping into that role. And after I turned like 24, 25, I really realized like, oh, this is one half of my DNA. I should really understand this. Mm. And that's when I started this group with my friend Lim Kim Do. It's called Viet Salon. So to get the community together, that's when I started learning Vietnamese. And I started just really kind of stepping into my Vietnamese-ness and accepting it and celebrating it, because I always felt like it was a part of myself that I had to hide to just sort of survive growing up. And then now, you know, I feel like it's, you know, it's something that I want to raise my kids with if I have kids. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that I want to keep the traditions alive with. I want to keep the language alive. I want to keep celebrations of death alive. I want to, you know, hopefully like, you know, really continue the pride in my culture. So that's the evolution of Vietnamese-ness in my life personally.
I love it.
Thank you. Thank you. I think writ large, I think that the cinema scene in Saigon is just exploding it's blown up because of government is more lenient with things. There's so many talented artists over there. I've been talking to a few. The cinema scene is just so amazing. There's Ambergris that got released. That was really cool. This movie. And I think there's going to be more Vietnamese American films made in Vietnam if there's still more leniency in how production goes there. And I think it's going to be one of the, you can look at Cannes and like a lot of the film festivals, a lot of Vietnamese American directors are just doing really well. You know, I saw Inside the Yellow Cocoon Shell is just gorgeous. It's such a scenic and cinematic environment, that country. So I think it will be kind of like what Korean cinema is in about 10 years, you know.
Quinton, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. The one thing that I look forward to with every guest, especially young people like you, is that I got to record you in your early days. I mean, this is pretty early for you. You will experience some breakout role and come back in a few years. And, you know, then we had this on tape, because I wish, you know, I've known Dustin for a long, long time. And I wish that I had the podcast 20 years ago when I met him, you know?
Sure, sure.
And so here we are. You and I were at that junction where this is early enough to kind of like explore what you're going through. And please always feel free to reach out and hit me up if you have a new release or a project that you want to talk about, because this is what this is here for.
Thank you, Kenneth. It's amazing what your platform is doing for the community and more than that. It really means a lot to like tune in and see other people of descent doing what I want to do. And I'm so honored to be a part of that. So thank you. I'm looking forward to checking in 10 years and
next year, next year, the year after. Yeah. Come when you have a project coming out, you know, that's what we're here for, you know?
Yeah.
People are seeing me on Instagram with Real Citrus, is ran by Brittany Tran, who, from day one, you could hear the credits at the end of each podcast. Brittany was part of that. So, you know, her and I, you know, we are just trying to put Vietnamese cinema out there on the map. So, you know, you're part of that world with us. So, you know, every time you have a new project, you hit us up and you hit me up, and, you know, we will make this all amplifying.
Mm-hmm. I will. So, I will. Thank you, Kenneth.
Thank you, Quinn. We'll see you very soon.
I'll see you soon.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.